The electrophoresis you're doing today is very similar. What?
This one, or this one?
It doesn't matter, actually.
Oh, okay. Okay,
I'll let me. And then you pour this.
Go ahead and pour the whole thing in. All right, so we're doing this for a different reason today, but it's really the same concept. The only thing that's different is what kind of thing we're looking for in the DNA. And we're looking for this ALU fragment in a part of the DNA that is non-coding. Your DNA, your entire genome is broken up into 23 sequences, right? Known as chromosomes. 46, because there's two of each. But the genes are just sequences within those chromosomes, right? And the genes, what defines a gene? What makes a gene a gene? You have base pairs for the entire length of the chromosome. So a gene is just a sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's, but so is everything else that is your DNA. No, not necessarily. What makes a gene is that that specific sequence is a set of instructions for how to make an RNA molecule, right? If it's a so-called protein-coding gene, then the type of RNA that's produced is messenger RNA, and that messenger RNA then carries the code to a ribosome, and you build a protein out of the information. There are other genes that code for the other kinds of RNA that cells have to have, like transfer RNA and microRNA and so on. All right? Well, those genes, whether they're protein-coding or non-protein-coding genes, are the vast minority of your overall DNA sequences. So all the rest of that DNA, over 95% of your DNA total, is so-called non-coding DNA. Because it's not a code for how to build anything. And we haven't figured out exactly what all that rest of that DNA does, but it's non-coding. All right? Within that non-coding DNA, you find a lot of stuff that repeats, sequences that repeat, even though they're not part of genes. And the reason that we find so many sequences over and over throughout the chromosomes is that they have been inserted in there by what are called transposable elements, also called transposons, also called jumping genes. Some people call them jumping genes. They're able to copy themselves into another part of the genome, and so they kind of reproduce. And so the ALU sequence is one of these transposable elements that we find in primates, including humans. And there's a hell of a lot of copies. Over 500,000 copies of these things are spread out in your genome. We're concerning ourselves just with one of those copies. The ALU sequence is itself a sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's, just a sequence of nucleotides. But the one instance of that we're looking for is in a slightly bigger sequence, if it's there at all, which is what the primers looked for when we did the PCR previously. Remember when we did the PCR? And in the PCR process, you have to be looking for a specific stretch of DNA for it to... for the primers to find those things and then amplify just that section of DNA. That's what you made billions of copies of. So even though this is a non-coding stretch of DNA, we can still use the word allele. Usually we use the word allele to mean a version of a gene, right? But we can still use the word allele because there can still be different kinds of that sequence in different humans. So there's, for a given stretch, the stretch that we amplified by PCR, either that stretch of DNA has the ALU sequence within it, or it doesn't. Okay? So there are two versions of the allele, but humans are diploid, so the other chromosome of that same type that also has that this sequence is either going to have ALU within it or not. Okay? So these aren't genes, but we use the word alleles, and therefore there's three possible genotypes, which is also an improper use of that word since it's not a gene, but you can have ALU in one of your sequences on the one chromosome, and you can also have it in the other one. In other words, you can be homozygous for having the ALU included in your sequence. Or you can be homozygous for not having it. Neither one of your two sequences have the ALU within it. Or you can be heterozygous, right? Those are the three possibilities. One of your sequences has it and the other one doesn't. And so that's what we look at when we, after we do the electrophoresis. What's going to happen is you'll have either one or two bands for an individual. Why would you have just one band in your electrophoresis lane? If this is the well, why would you have just one band? Because you're homozygous. If both of your sequences have ALU within it, they'll both be the same size. And they'll both travel at the same speed, and they'll therefore form one band. If neither of them have it, those sequences will also be the same size, and they'll be a single band, but they will be smaller because they don't have the ALU within it. And so that single band would travel even farther. That makes sense? Because it's smaller. But if you're heterozygous, then you'll form two bands, one of each size. Those are the possibilities. So, in this case, unlike last time, we need to pay attention to how big the fragment is for a given band. Because there's two possible ones that will have one band, right? It's not just the fact that there's one band, we need to know how big the fragment is in that band. So that's why we use a different lane that's going to form what's called a ladder or a ruler, and we use a molecular mass marker that we load into this sample in order to make a measurement of the bands in the other lanes. The molecular mass marker is really just a standard mixture of DNA molecules of different sizes, or different fragment sizes, but they're known sizes. When you put them all into a mixture, into one well, they're going to electrophorese at different speeds, right? And this is why it's called a ladder. After they've electrophoresed, the bands make a pattern that looks like the rungs of a ladder. But since you knew going into it how big the sizes are, you can put little numbers next to them, whatever those numbers are, and say, something that is this size should travel this far. And therefore, by comparing your sample, if you have two, you definitely know that it's heterozygous. But if you have only one, you look at the ladder and see how big it is. Right? If it's bigger, there's two possible sizes. I can't remember what they are, like 715 base pairs and 450 or something like that. So if it's the 450 or whatever it is, that's the smaller possibility, right? What would that, if you have only one band of 450, whatever it is, what would that be? What is the, which one of those genotypes would it be? The bottom one, exactly. Two identical short sequences, because neither one of them has ALU. One band of 700 and whatever would be this one, and two bands would be this one. Does that all make sense? Okay, good. In that case, we have to talk just briefly about the other thing we're doing today, which is what? Microscopy. And since this is not necessarily a major's class, I have to assume that you haven't actually heard the standard microscopy lecture, and so I'm going to talk about the microscope itself. That's a dissecting scope. Take your things off, though, so we can look at these scopes. Microscopy is not actually very easy if you haven't done it a lot. And probably most of you will use these microscopes incorrectly today, but I'm going to tell you how to correctly use a microscope. First of all, these scopes, at the most general level, what kind of microscopes are these? They are light microscopes, right, as opposed to electron microscopes. They use humanly visible light that's passed through the sample. That's why they're light microscopes. Both of these, though, are light microscopes, so even more specifically, this one is a slide scope, whereas this one's a dissecting scope. A slide scope is what you're going to use to look at slides with. And even more specifically, the slide scope is an example of a compound microscope. What is it that makes it a compound scope? Actually, no. That's not what makes it compound. Yeah. No, that's what makes it a binocular scope. The fact that you look through two different lenses is what gives you the stereoscopic vision or the depth perception. That is makes it binocular. What makes a scope compound is that there are the image gets magnified twice in sequence because there are two different kinds of lenses that light passes through in sequence. So it goes through one lens first, gets magnified a certain amount, and then before it goes into your eye, it passes through another lens and gets magnified again. What are those two kinds of lenses called? Ocular lenses and objective lenses, right. Now, why is an objective lens called an objective lens? Well, you can, in certain models like these, change the magnification, but that's not why they're called objectives. They're called the objective lens because it is close to the object that you're trying to magnify. So the objective lens, and the most basic compound scope would have a single objective and a single ocular lens. This model happens to have four different objectives, so you can choose from different ones, and each has its own magnification. They're on this swivel. What is this swivel called? The nose piece, right. So those are the objective lenses. These are the ocular lenses. This one happens to be binocular, meaning that there are two ocular lenses. But why are those called ocular lenses? Right, because ocular means of the eye. Okay, so in this model, the ocular lenses have a fixed magnification of 10 times. And so they magnify the image 10 times, but like I said, it's already been magnified by the objective first. That magnification depends on which objective lens you have chosen. So that's on the barrel. And on this one, the lowest level one is the red banded one, which is 4x. The total magnification, since it's a magnification of a magnification, is just the product of the two individual magnifications. So using that lowest powered objective, you would have a total magnification of 4 times 10, or 400 times. All right? On a scope that has multiple objective lenses like this, what is the objective lens with the lowest magnification called? Called the scanning lens. And it's called a scanning lens because with the lowest magnification, you have the largest field of view. Field of view is the circle that you see when you look through it. Well, that circle always looks the same size to you, but it actually is a bigger or smaller part of the overall slide that you're looking at, depending on which objective lens you're using. At the 4X or the scanning lens, it's like being zoomed out. You see a bigger area of the lens, which is why everything in it looks smaller. Okay? So that allows you to get a wide-angle view of the slide, whatever is on the slide, and scan around and see something interesting that you can then put in the center and then go up in magnification by changing the objective lenses and get a closer view. All right? By the way, this is not only a compound scope, but it's also an example of what we call a parfocal scope. A parfocal scope is one that will stay at least roughly in focus after you've focused the first objective. You can swivel the nose piece and go up in magnification by changing to another objective. And if it's parfocal, it should stay at least roughly in focus, and all you'd have to tweak is the fine focus knob. All right? Now, speaking of focus, the way you focus a microscope is to place the slide at the correct distance from the lens for it to be at the focal point. This is actually accomplished by raising or lowering the platform that the slide rests on. What is that platform called? It's called the stage, and the mechanical stage, which is different, is actually on top of the stage. The mechanical stage includes the clamp that you should always load a slide into, not paying any attention to whether the slide is centered on the light or not. Just always put it in the clamp the same exact way. The mechanical stage is called the mechanical stage because it's operated by two concentric knobs that hang down to the right of the stage and work kind of like an etch-a-sketch. There's one for left and right. There's one for forward and backward. So that's how you actually, after having loaded a slide, move to a certain part of the slide. Don't touch the slide and try to move it. Move the mechanical stage instead. Okay, so light is coming from a lamp in the bottom, and by the way, a common mistake is to just think that the most possible light is best always, and that's not the case. It'll wash out your image. So there are actually two major ways that you can adjust the amount of light that's going through your sample. What are those two ways? The aperture, which can also be called the iris, which can also be called the diaphragm. Those are all the same thing. Those are controlled by a little slider that you can move right or left on the condenser that's just below the stage. Now, what you're doing is stopping down or opening up, just like on an SLR camera, changing the f-stop by adjusting the width of the hole the light goes through. And that certainly will affect the amount of light going through the sample. But it also can affect depth of focus, same way it does in photography. So there's another way that is a way to change the amount of light. And the only thing that it does is change the amount of light. What's that other way? By what control? But what do most people call a rheostat? A dimmer, yes. So the power switch on this model is the same thing as the dimmer. You know, it has a click. That'll turn it on, but you can then adjust the amount of light. And just remember it's there. Play around with the amount of light and also play around with the aperture. Okay, now the proper use of this thing. The focus knobs are in duplicate. They're concentric as well. There's a large ring, which is the coarse focus. And notice it greatly affects the height of the vertical position of the stage. The fine focus doesn't change it as much, nearly as much. Now, like I said, there's only one position at which the slide will be in focus. And when you're first coming to the microscope, you should always start with the stage all the way down. And you should always start with the scanning lens in place. First of all, the scanning lens is by far the easiest one to focus, so that's why you should start with it. It also gives you more room to load your slide because it's shorter. And it also is the one you should start with because it allows you to scan the slide for something interesting. But there are a couple reasons why you should start with the stage all the way down. One is that it also gives you more room to load your slide. But the more important reason is that if you just slap a slide on there in the position the stage was from whatever last time it was used, it's almost certainly not going to be in perfect focus. But you're not going to know whether it's out of focus because the stage is too high or because it's too low. And therefore, if you assume it's too high and you bring it down, but actually it was too low already, you're just making it worse and it'll never get into focus. Starting at one end, the bottom, you know that it's out of focus, but because it's too low, and therefore if you keep going up, eventually it should pop into focus, as long as you have it centered on the light using the mechanical stage. All right, so that's how you should start. But there are a couple adjustments that you need to make to personalize the scope. One adjustment is to put in the correct interpupillary distance. The interpupillary distance is the distance between your two pupils. That's not a constant among humans. It changes from individual to individual. People have closely spaced or far spaced eyes. And you do that just by grabbing the two oculars and moving them together or farther apart. This is the number one reason why people say, this won't work for me, I see double. Because you haven't bothered to adjust the interpupillary distance. Okay. That's one adjustment that you need to make to the oculars for your eyes. Assuming you've done that, and you've loaded the slide, and you start on the scanning lens with the stage all the way down, what you should be doing at this point is keeping your left eye closed and look through just the right ocular with your right eye only. Use the coarse focus knob, bring it up until something pops into focus, get it as good as you can with the coarse, and then use the fine focus until it's as good as it's going to get for that right eye. Then take your hand off of the focus knobs and leave them off the focus knobs because you don't want to mess up that focus you just did for your right eye. Close your right eye, open your left eye, and look only through the left ocular. If it's still in perfect focus, then you're done, but chances are it won't be. If it's not, then rotate the left ocular itself, which has its own little focus. And this allows you to adjust for differences in your two eyes' ability to focus, which isn't necessarily equal. Okay? Once those are set, then if you open both eyes, it should be perfectly in focus for both of them. Does that all make sense? Well, that's how to properly use a scope, but I rarely see that being done. So by now, you probably should have just about set up gels. It looks like you do. And while that, you know, definitely load the gels and get those running immediately, but while they're running, you have some microscopy to do to fill the time.